is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Pat Baldwin, head men's basketball coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and you're listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
When I design a practice, then every single day I try to design it in a way that where I know that after the practice, my players are a little bit smarter than before practice.
Pascal Muurs is a professional basketball coach with experience at the highest level in Belgium, the Netherlands, France, and Luxembourg. Pascal was part of the coaching staff for the NCAA Division I St. Joseph Hawks as well. Pascal is an expert in advanced basketball analytics with a PhD in mathematics. He is a skilled speaker at coaching clinics. He has been invited to 3 different continents. He's an analyst on Belgian TV for 11 sports. Pascal is passionate about sharing his knowledge with coaches throughout the world. He writes a coaching blog that can be found at pascalmuurs.com, and Muurs has completed his prestigious FIBA Europe Coaching Certificate. Thanks for checking out the Hoop Heads podcast. Our lineup of podcast guests includes some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. They'll share insights to help you grow as a coach, improve as a player, or enhance your experience of the game as a parent. You'll gain new perspectives on what the best coaches are doing, how they do it, and why they do it. We hope to make you think and challenge you to consider your approach to the game of basketball. Please subscribe to the Hoop Heads Pod and leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show. Help us grow the game by telling your friends and colleagues about the Hoop Heads Podcast so they can give us a listen too. Get your pen and paper ready as you listen to this episode with Pascal Muurs, Belgian professional basketball coach. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel, unfortunately, this morning. But we are pleased to be joined by Pascal Muurs, European professional basketball coach. Pascal, thank you for joining us here on the Hoop Heads Pod.
Hello, Mike. It's a big pleasure to be here, so thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to dig into all the things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball internationally. I want to start out by talking to you about how you got into the game of basketball as a young kid, and what made you fall in love with the game?
Well, actually, I think I started out playing basketball at the age of 10, and that was mainly because my older brother was playing, and we had, in my hometown in Belgium, Europe, we had like a basketball club like 5 minutes away from our home. That was my home club. It's also the club where 15 years later I coached my very first U team. And actually, it's quite funny, Mike. I'm sitting right now here at a coffee table, and actually it is made of the wooden floor of that exact same basketball gym.
That's awesome.
A couple of years ago, they tore the building down, and actually I was happy to be able to recover some of the wooden pieces, and with a little help, we turned it into a coffee table.
That is fantastic. How did you know that they were tearing it down? Were you in town? How did you find out about it? And then how did you go about making sure that you were able to salvage some of the floor? Because that's really a cool thing that you'll, I'm sure, have for the rest of your life.
Well, yeah, it's quite funny. So the timing of tearing it down, there wasn't really a secret, because it's still my hometown. It's the city where I went to school. It's the city where still my parents and friends live. So, of course, I knew that they would tear it down. But actually, with a couple of friends, we asked up front, like the people who were responsible, can we recover some pieces of the wooden floor? And actually, they told us, no, it's impossible, because we sold the whole thing and they will use the floor in a different building for something else. But then actually when they tear it down, it was, for us, it was like an emotional happening because we spent all of our youth there. So we went there to watch it, to see it, actually with a little tear in our eyes. And actually, we just noticed that the wooden pieces, they were just out there and they completely destroyed it. So actually, we picked up some pieces and afterwards we put them back together and we turned it into a table.
That is very cool. That is very cool. I once looked at a house that my wife and I were thinking about buying, and it wasn't a basketball court that I had played on, but the entire wooden floor of one of the rooms in the house was an actual wooden floor from a local school here near where I grew up. And it was very cool to walk in and have it feel like a basketball court floor. I almost bought the house just because it had a basketball court for the floor. It was very cool back in the day.
Yeah, it's cool, but it's one of the nicest memories I have from my childhood, just because I know how many hours I spent on that wooden piece.
Absolutely.
So actually, I really like it.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's something that every time you look at, I'm sure it brings back good memories of when you were a kid and playing basketball on that floor. What was it about the game once you got into it and you kind of were following in your brother's footsteps? What was it about the game that you really liked once you started getting into it and playing a little bit more?
It's everything together. It's being with your friends. It's giving it all. It's the atmosphere of losing together, winning together. It's the whole NBA too. It was back in the days when the NBA in Europe was just for free on national TV. And I remember it. It was also the decade. It was 92. It was the Bulls were chasing their second title. Paxson was making the game winner three against the Phoenix Suns. It's actually the era where I was recording in the middle of the night. I was recording the radio station in the U.S., the live stream of the game. And then afterwards, the day after, I would listen to that live stream. So it tells you something about how crazy I was about the game when I was such a young age.
Yeah, I think we take for granted here in America that games are on at times that are normal for our, you know, for our time zones. And so when you're in another part of the country, another part of the world, and you're trying to get access to NBA games, you sometimes forget here in the United States that those games are coming out in the middle of the night or 4 a.m. or whatever it might be. When you think back to that time, who was your favorite player? Was it the Bulls? Was it Jordan? Who was it that you kind of looked up to and said, I got to watch this person whenever I get an opportunity, or in your case, then listening to it on the radio?
Well, of course it was the Bulls. At that age, or in that time, you didn't have another choice. It was the Bulls, and of course, Michael Jordan is the greatest player ever to have played the game. But more specifically, actually, I was looking to the small guys. Like, I was a small white guy, not too physical. So to be very honest, my example was more like a John Paxson, a John Armstrong, those type of guys, like the shooters, Mark Price, you had Tom Stockton, you had Dan Majerle, the great shooter of the Phoenix Suns. Actually, I was looking more to those type of guys than the real physical ones like Jordan, like Dunks and so on, like Shaquille O'Neal. Actually, maybe I was quite realistic about what I could achieve myself.
Yeah, I think that for me, I think what you just said rings true for me, because I had guys like, I love Jordan, my favorite player of all time, and yet I love him from a standpoint of, I knew from a very young age that he could do things physically that I just never was going to ever be able to accomplish. And so just like you, when I think about the players that I tried to emulate, it's funny that you said Mark Price. We were fortunate enough here in Cleveland that we got to watch Mark play when I was a kid. He was definitely one of my favorite players to watch when he was with the Cavs. And then we were fortunate enough early on in the podcast, we were fortunate enough to have Mark on the show. And so for me, that was a thrill to be able to spend an hour talking basketball with Mark Price, who was a guy that growing up when I was in middle school, high school, that I watched play, and went to the games and was a big fan of him here in Cleveland where we live. And so he was definitely one of those guys that was on the short list. And when you think about players to want to be able to emulate their game, he's certainly a guy that was, I think, probably ahead of his time. If you put him in today's game with the spread offenses and the amount of threes that guys are taking, I think he would have been even more of a star than he was back in the time that he played, just because of how the game has changed and we've spread things out. Have you had a chance to, just curious, while everybody's been in this quarantine situation, have you had a chance to go back and watch any of the older games from that Bulls era, say the late 80s, early 90s, Magic, Bird, Jordan, watch any of those games? And I'm always struck by, and I've done a little bit more checking those games out since I've had more time, just how different the game was back in that era compared to how the game is played today.
Yeah, actually I did. Like 1-2 weeks ago, because of the coronavirus, of course, they were broadcasting those games here too in Belgium. And actually I was watching one of those games. It was the Bulls against Utah in 98.
Okay.
And actually I was looking at it from different glasses, in the sense that right now, actually, I was looking at it from a standpoint of watching the triangle in action. And actually, I noticed how different you look to a game compared to 20, 30 years ago. Because back then, I would watch as a little kid, as a fan to the game. And then you watch it completely different as being a coach. And of course, now you see all those actions, you see the motions in offense, you see the patterns, you see the triangle offense, and you also see the physicality. So, of course, the game has changed a lot, not to mention how few threes they took back in the days. And if you look at it, how it turned into today, well, that's just a different world.
But absolutely.
On the other side, that's one of the reasons why I love the game. Like, because also as a coach, you have to keep evolving, because the game is changing every single year. And you cannot just take a time out of a couple of years and come back and teach and pray the same things, because just the game has changed.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I'm struck by, when I watch games from that era, the biggest thing that I'm struck by, I think there are two, and you know, you could get into more of the specifics of the X's and O's, but what I'm struck by is the amount of congestion in the lane. So the number of guys who are posting up down on the block, even when, you know, you have Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen out on the wing, and you're like, why don't guys just get out of the way so they can just go by their man and score? And instead you have Bill Cartwright or Will Perdue, you know, posted up down on the block, kind of in the way. And when somebody drives in, there's like eight bodies in the lane. So that's the one thing that strikes me. And then the other one that you mentioned is just how guys are spotted up and they're theoretically trying to space the floor, and yet they're all just 1 or 2 feet inside the 3-point line instead of taking that 1 or 2 steps back and being behind the three. And it's kind of amazing, as you said, that the game evolves and coaches get smarter and people start looking, and then something starts to work and coaches copy it, which we know is a big part of how the game evolves, is somebody comes up with something that they want to try and they start trying it and it starts working. And then before you know it, people copy it and innovate off of that and add things to it. And before you know it, we have a game that, if you watch a game in 2019, 2020 versus you watch a game from 1989 or 1990, it's just a completely different look and feel to what that game looks like. And as you said, it's been very interesting to see how the game has changed. And that's what makes coaching the game of basketball so fun, is that it's such a dynamic game and it's always evolving and changing. So when you think back to when you were younger, did you always know somewhere in the back of your mind that coaching basketball was something that you might want to do? Or when you were a kid, were you just kind of focused on loving the game as a player and then coaching came to you later on in life? So how would you say you came to the coaching profession?
Well, actually, I knew very early that I was completely crazy about the game. Like I told you, like what I would do to record those games in the middle of the night and then the day after watch it. Let me give you one more example. And actually, it is also about 98, about the period where I re-saw a game last week. Actually, in 98, I was one of the few Europeans that was still able to see Michael Jordan play a live game in his last season with the Bulls. And actually, the story is a little bit funny too, because I had one of my best friends, of course, and he was a little bit spoiled, and he was turning 18. And actually, his parents almost begged him, like, yeah, you have to come with us on holiday one more time, and then afterwards you're old enough and you can go on holiday. And
gotcha.
He said, okay, Mom, let's do that, but I have two conditions. First of all, we're going to see Michael Jordan play. And secondly, I have to take a friend there. I guess it was a friend.
There you go. Wow.
And actually, around Christmas, 98, we traveled to the U.S. for a couple of days. We went to Chicago. We had to go on the black market to buy the last tickets. I think at that time we spent like $100 for one ticket, which at that point was pretty expensive. And we were really at the upper row in the arena in Chicago, but it was just great. But talking about 98, actually, that was also the moment that here in Belgium, I had to start my studies. And at 98, I think I can say that I was a decent player. Like, I was a starting five player, and we played for the championship in Belgium. So that means in my generation, I was for sure not a bad player. But on the other hand, there never was a real hope. I didn't have the physicality, neither I had the size to make it as a professional player. And actually, with my parents and so on, we at that point, everybody agreed that the priority should go to my studies. And that's how it happened. It was 98, the moment where I went to university. I went to study mathematics, and actually I tried it for 1-2 years to play at the highest possible level in Belgium, but it was so hard to combine it with my studies that actually I gave up a little bit, and I just went to play with my friends back in my hometown in combination with my studies. And actually, after 4 years of my master's degrees in mathematics, I started a PhD also in mathematics. And actually, it was during that PhD that in my hometown club that actually people from the club, they asked my help, like, hey, well, you're on Friday afternoon, we have a group of 20 kids, and it would be great if you could help us out just to give practice. And basically, that's how I started coaching. That's my very first experience. And first of all, I just liked it. So the year after, I took one new team on a very basic level in Belgium. I was like the under 14 team. I coached them, and I liked it. And that's the most important thing. So I took my first coaching degree. And then actually, when I finished my PhD, I had to apply for some jobs. And I remember that with a PhD in mathematics, it's quite easy to find some jobs. And I remember a job interview in Antwerp, one of the biggest cities in Belgium, to work at a bank, at the headquarters of a bank with my background in mathematics. And I was looking around there. They had a really good offer for me for the job. But I was looking around, and I just saw people in suits, and they all looked so unhappy. And then I was thinking the days afterwards, so they offered me the job. And the days afterwards, I was thinking, no, I don't want to do that job, because then I cannot coach my under-6 team in my hometown anymore. And I don't want to move to Antwerp, to the big city, just for that job in a bank where everybody looks unhappy. And actually, that's the reason why I didn't take the job. And that's the reason why at that point I started out teaching in my hometown, because then I knew I can combine it with basketball. So I started teaching, but at the same time, every single day, I would be in that gym, the one of the wooden floor, the one of my coffee table. First of all, to just play for myself, to have a little bit of fun. But actually, next to it, almost every day, I was giving practices to U teams. And actually, there, it was like a virus. Like, it was so addictive. I really, really liked it. And I also became very hungry. So year after year, I took another coaching degree. summer I would travel to London in the UK to follow a coaching clinic. I would travel one school holiday to Spain to watch in 1 week as many practices as possible from the little kids till the first team, the professional team, just to learn as a coach. And I must say, from that period on, it has bit me like a virus, and it only gets bigger and bigger, and I only get hungry to more and more knowledge. And like we said a couple of minutes ago, the game of basketball, it's great because you'll never ever come to a point where you say, now I know it all. And from here, I can stop learning and I know how it works. Now, one of the reasons is, of course, that the game of basketball, that it keeps on evolving, but also, yeah, it's just too complex to know it all. I will never get to that point. And that's quite challenging to me.
I love that story. I have a similar story about how I became a teacher. And I went to school and got a degree in business. And growing up as a kid, my father was a university professor. My mother was an elementary school teacher. So I had two parents who both were in education. And therefore, they were both home all the time in the summer. And so when I got done with my college playing career and graduated from school, it was time for me to go out just like you and get a job. And I went out on a couple interviews and had a couple of different job offers and had a few days to kind of mull over those job offers. And I started thinking about what the jobs would entail, and I came to the realization that they wanted me to put on a suit and be working in July. And I had never seen anybody put on a suit and go to work in July because both my parents were teachers. And basketball had always been such a huge part of my life. But I was a kid who, when I went to college, I was confused about what I wanted to do. Never really wanted to do anything, honestly, except play basketball. That was pretty much the focus of my life when I was a young kid. And when I started thinking about, boy, do I want to work all summer in some job that has nothing to do with basketball? And I came to the realization that I didn't. And from there, just like you, I decided, hey, I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to get a teaching certificate, and I'm going to get into teaching and coaching. And from there, it ended up being a great decision, and my life went a completely different direction. So I can completely relate as you were telling that story. In my mind, I'm just laughing in my head because it's very, very similar to my own, you know, to my own story. And then like you, I think that once that coaching bug grabs you, I think then you want to continue to pursue it and you want to continue to be able to learn about the game. And then for me, over the course of time, I think it became about being able to use the game to have an impact on people. So when you think about your first experiences coaching those youth teams, what was it about coaching that really grabbed you? What part of coaching was the first thing that you really felt like, man, this is what I want to do? What aspect of coaching was important to you?
I think it is the moment you see the first progressions that you can really help somebody to get better at something. Because you work with kids and you see them try things, and your job as a coach is to teach them tricks, show them tricks that will help them. And if you see the smallest result, and if you see them being happy because now they can do something which before they couldn't do, that's one thing. And the second thing is also to have them on the same page. You start out with a bunch of kids like 10 or 15, and you start in summer and they're completely on a different page. They don't think the same about basketball. And actually what you try to do is you try to create a team. You try to find a common bond on which you want to work. And then, of course, once you get into a rhythm of practices, one big thing that for me is the game day adrenaline. That's something over summer. It's one of the things I miss first. Right now, during the coronavirus, I miss the adrenaline of the game. And then for me, it doesn't matter at all at which level you're coaching. Are you coaching at the pro level? or are you coaching a kids team on Saturday? Game day is game day. It all doesn't matter. If you're really passionate about it, game day is the best day of the week.
I think that is so true. I mean, I think that, you know, you talk to different coaches, and I've talked to some people who talk about how much they enjoy the practices and they don't necessarily enjoy the games as much as a coach. And I think I was probably not the complete opposite, but I definitely am like you. Like, I enjoy getting out there for a game as a coach. I enjoy that adrenaline rush, as you said. And to me, the opportunity to play a game is the opportunity then to measure yourself and all the things that you've done in preparation for that game. To me, that's fun, that's exciting, and that's something that I think any coach is going to enjoy. And it sounds like that's what you were able to find. You were able to find your joy in that, and being able to have that excitement. And as you said, it doesn't matter what level. I think that we all, whether you're coaching a bunch of 10-year-olds or you're coaching a professional team, I think ultimately coaching is coaching. And that's one of the things that I found, Pascal, with the podcast, is we've talked to coaches that are youth coaches, and we've talked to coaches who coach players at the professional level. And regardless of which level they're coaching at, you can see their passion for the game. You can see their preparation. You can see the things that they do to use the game to have an impact on kids. And that's really something that I think is very, very important, is how do you use the game to improve the lives of your players? And so if you go back to the beginning of your career and you started thinking about, okay, I'm coaching this youth team, what did you eventually see? What were your goals early on in the game in terms of coaching? Did you have in your mind that someday you'd like to move up and work with older, more experienced players? What was kind of your career path that you saw early on?
Well, very early on, I didn't have a career path, because you have to know that that hometown club I'm talking about, well, it must be, I live in a very small town in a corner of Belgium, and actually it was a very basic and low level basketball club. So at that point, when they asked me to help out with the youth team, I didn't have a career path at all. And actually, I took a team, and then the next year I took a team, and everything was going so well, and I was doing the coaching degrees, when actually the committee of the club, they came up to me, and actually they wanted to play. They had one generation of girls, and the year after, they would like to take the challenge on to play on a national level with that youth team. And actually, that would have been the very first time in the history of the club. It's a club with a tradition of, back then, it was like 30, 40 years. And it would be the very first time in the history that they would play on a national level, but they asked me to do it. And without thinking twice, I immediately said yes. And to be honest, we had our ass kicked every single week. Like, we lost by 100 to 40. But we had such a great group of girls. And week after week, we just saw that loss as an extra motivation. And I remember it's like near the end of the season, there was one game which we were able to win by 1 point. Couple of weeks or months before that, we would lose the same game with 40, 50 points. But at that point, we were able to win one single game that season with a buzzer beater in the last second. And I remember that day as it was yesterday. All the girls, they were crying. Everybody was celebrating on the court. And actually, with that generation of girls, whenever I meet them right now in summer in my hometown, very often we start talking again about that season, because all those girls, they have such great memories to that season where they lost every single game big time. But actually, so people also saw the progression with the team we made back then. But actually, in my region, we had like a first division female club, the highest level in Belgium. And actually, they asked me to run one of their youth teams. No, it went great, and they asked me to assist on a higher age. And actually, two years later, I was assisting in the first division in Belgium, but it was also with the female team. And then actually, near the end of the season, I was able to take over because we had bad results and the head coach was fired. So actually, I took over, and at the end of the season, we unexpectedly made it to the playoffs. And in that playoffs, actually, that's funny too, you might know her, we were beaten by Ypres in Belgium with a girl named Emma Miesemann. And Emma Miesemann, right now, she's the biggest Belgian star in basketball. She won the MVP of the EuroLeague. And also last season, she was called MVP of the finals of the WNBA. But when we were playing her, she must have been 17 or 18 years old. But already then in Belgium, she was one of the best players of the league. So we got kicked out by her, which for us still was an unexpected success that season. And actually, that season for me, that was the intro, because at that point, I was, by then, I must have been around 31 years old. Then I got my first professional offer in coaching basketball. And I was coming from France, and it was also a female club, but actually they were competing in the EuroLeague women at that point. And they asked me to be the assistant coach of the first team and at the same time also be like the youth director of two youth teams. And actually that for me, that was the start of my coaching career. And actually back then in 2 years time, I really got a perspective from being a coach in my local club to really think, hey, maybe I do have a future into basketball. And actually, the choice of female basketball, that was actually just an accident. I just rolled in there because I started out with a girls' team.
All right. I want to ask you two things. So one, I want to go back to that very first team that you talked about that won one game on the buzzer beater, and the fact that you still see the girls from that team and that they all have such fond memories of being a part of that. And so to me, that's something that speaks to what you were able to do as a coach, because we all know, let's face it, that we can talk about some of these other things, but wins and losses to coaches who are competitive are important. And we know that if you have a choice between winning and losing, it's a lot more fun to win games than it is to lose. So what did you do during the course of that season to keep those girls engaged and having fun so that even though by the measure of the scoreboard, they weren't successful, it wasn't a successful season from a one-loss standpoint, but yet, really, when we think about what basketball coaching is all about, the fact that those girls still have fond memories and that you still have a relationship with them tells me that you were doing something right during that season to be able to keep all those players engaged and enjoying being part of that team. So what do you remember about that in terms of what you did or what that team was like? Because I think there's a lesson there to be learned for coaches of how do you keep your players engaged when things aren't going perfectly in terms of the scoreboard?
Well, there are a couple of things. And one of the things is make it a bunch of friends. You have to realize that at that point, like I told you, every game we would lose it big time. So sometimes in gyms, in away games, we would be laughed at because we were losing big time. So first of all, in some way, you create something like us against the rest of the world. Everybody is against us. Some people will laugh at us. Some people will say, hey, they can't play basketball. They didn't win a single game this season yet. And actually, what you do create is you have to focus on the common grounds. And you have something with that team, that the connection that nobody else has. And you have something unique within your team. And what is also very important, of course, is just make them focus not on the final result of that game. Because even before the season started, we realized that it would be very, very hard to win a single game during that season. So that also means that practice after practice, game after game, we would not only focus on the final result of the game, because otherwise, let's be honest, then it would be a very sad season with a lot of crying and what so on. So that also means that every week we would focus on some of the things we did way better than before. And it was also the period where I would bring my camera to practice. I would film some things, which at that point would be way more difficult than right now, where you just take your smartphone, you film something, and you show it to the girls. But back then, I really made an effort to do it and to film some things and then talk it through with some of the girls. But I think those are a couple of ingredients you for sure have to do. And then you can create something unique. And like I tell you, sometimes when I meet those girls, we just bring up memories, and everybody agrees it's one of the best seasons they had in their whole playing career, while never ever did they lose more games or did they lose them as bad as during that season.
That's so much fun. I think that's a great, great, great story. If we could share that story with every young coach out there who's just getting started or thinking about getting started in coaching, to me, that epitomizes really what a good coach is all about. Because the fact that you were able to create, especially when we're talking about a youth level team, that you were able to create a situation where they weren't successful on the scoreboard by sort of the traditional measurement, and yet, if you talk to those girls, they're going to tell you that their experience with the game of basketball was a good one from that season. And I'm sure that inspired them to want to keep on playing. And obviously, as you said, they developed friendships amongst themselves with the team. And clearly there was a relationship between you as their coach and them as players. And to me, that's something that you can't replace. And we can all talk about coaching at the highest level and wins and losses, and we know that in a lot of cases that's how coaches are judged, by how many games they win and lose. But I think there's this whole other piece of it that story touches on, which is, unless you're coaching at the very, very highest levels, so much of what basketball coaching is, yes, teaching the kids how to play basketball, but it's also teaching them about life. It's teaching them about how to be a good teammate. It's teaching about how to interact with people. It's teaching them about things from the game that can impact them later on in their life with whatever it is that they decide to do. And to me, that's a perfect story to share that with people. And then the second thing I want to ask, go ahead.
If I can interrupt you.
Sure, absolutely.
It's one of the saddest thing about professional basketball, because sometimes I do have some regrets to that period of just playing and coaching for fun. Because like we are discussing right now, having such a season with such a team and getting that team to win one single game, probably there we did a better job than the team that finished first. And at that point, it all doesn't matter. It wasn't my professional job, and my job wasn't on the line. We were just all doing that because we loved it and because we're so passionate about it. And I'm sure that it's the story I tell you right now, that's one example. I hope and I think that you have some listeners that actually are thinking that they're exactly in the same situation, which is probably true. And you should really be proud about what you have accomplished. But then at one moment when you enter professional basketball, like you say, then it's all about how many wins you have. And I can imagine that you have so many championships and so many different leagues where the coach of the team, which is last in the standings or which is somewhere halfway the standings, is doing a way better job than the coach who puts on the ring after the season. And actually, that's pretty sad about our job, because we have so much influence on the team and on the players. If you look at all over the sports, I cannot think of one sport where actually the influence of the coach is as big as in basketball. For sure, also during the games, like with the timeouts, with the no limits on the number of subs, with the play calling, you're so close to the court, and so on. But there's no direct result. If the difference between two teams is 20 points, maybe you do a miraculous job if you only lose that game by one instead of 20. Then you did almost a miracle. But a loss is a loss. And at one point, the committee, the president will look at your ranking, your standing. That's the number of losses. That's the number of wins. And maybe at that point, your job is on the line and you risk getting fired, even if you did the most miraculous job on earth.
That's so true. I think it's interesting when you have that conversation, because ultimately, as you said, if I think about the professional level, whether that's here in the United States or in Europe, or you think about the university college level here in the United States, and those coaches at those levels are clearly ultimately judged by their one loss record. And that's, I don't want to say it's completely the only thing that matters, but the bottom line is it's very, very close to being the only thing that matters. And yet we know that as coaches, that there are so many other things that we try to do day to day to help our team improve, to help our players improve as players, but also as people, and to be able to build relationships with our players, but also help the players build relationships with one another. And all those things are so critically important. And yet what it comes down to is we're ultimately judged by wins and losses. And so I think that's something that I'm guessing, and I've never coached at either one of those levels, but I was able to play at the university level. But I know that those coaches have to feel a tremendous amount of strain and pressure. And it's oftentimes, I'm guessing it can lead them to make decisions that, as you said, if you could go back and just be coaching that team where everybody's just playing for fun, they would probably make different decisions, maybe about the type of people that they bring into the team. And sometimes coaches sacrifice their standards in order to win games. And I think that's a danger that we run into at the highest levels of basketball. Have you seen that, some of those situations in some of the places that you've been?
Absolutely. I see college basketball in the U.S. as something completely different. There you see coaches with a long career at the same university. But here in Europe, you have so many leagues and so many clubs where there is really a hire and fire policy. And that's concerning the import players, but it's also concerning the coaches. And actually, that's ruining the game of basketball. Because I'll give you one concrete example. For instance, here in Belgium, my home country, we have a professional league. But actually, whenever a Belgian coach gets the chance to take over a team from day one, the pressure to win is so high. So it means that here you can have a Belgian coach that proved himself over years in either abroad, either in second division. And then finally, he gets his chance, but whenever he loses three games in a row, he should be worried about his job. And what are the consequences? Not only is it ridiculous, because wins and losses, it depends on so many factors than just coaching, but it's also, it holds coaches from bringing Belgian and local talent into the team. Because they are blamed for playing with six import players, and they play mainly with the import players, and they don't bring new Belgian talent. But why? Of course, because their job is on the line. If my job is on the line for one play and I have to pick the player that will take that last shot, well, very likely I will also go look to the professional player that took that shot several times in his career, and not the Belgian rookie of 17 years old who's a bit shaky. But then, of course, if you look to the longer term, for the health of the club and so on, also for the progression, for the bond with the local fans and so on, of course, it would be way better if that Belgian club can launch some domestic players on the highest level. But never does the coach get the opportunity. And I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's one of the examples where where the pressure on the coach is that high.
That makes a lot of sense. How would you, if you could redesign the Belgian system, so if you could redesign it from top to bottom, what would that look like? How would you change things so that it would offer the opportunity for more homegrown players to be able to come up through the system and eventually be able to play and play an integral role on their team at the highest levels? How would you change things there in Belgium?
I think there is a big lack of basketball knowledge with the decision makers in European clubs. And Belgium is a good example of that. What would I change? Well, for instance, right now in Belgium for several years already, it is like a closed championship. So it's a bit the NBA style. The last team of the ranking, they don't drop down to a second division, basically because no second division teams are financially capable to make it to the next level because there is a huge gap between the professional level and the second division. So actually, that's not a reason not to put everything on the domestic players. Right now in Belgium, we have a rule where on the game sheet, you have to have 6 domestic players, which also means that for some clubs, they opt for having 6 import players. But right here in Belgium, you have a league of 10 professional teams, and we have teams that are competing for the 6th or 7th spot in the ranking without any risk to drop down to second division, and still they gamble on having 6 import players, which for me is something ridiculous. What would I change? I would change the vision of the club. I really think that being a professional team in Belgium, you have to make your own way. You just don't have to run behind some of the other teams that do the same thing. You have to declare your vision and your ambitions over the midterm. And I'm sure that if you can profile yourselves as being the Belgian club where young talent gets his chance and will get confidence and will go by that, but also you will be able to attract some of the best Belgian talents and young players because they know what they'll get in their team. And right now you have so many teams in Belgium that promise everything to their Belgian players until they sign the contract. And once the contract is signed, they're at the end of the bench because then they play with 6 import players. And then you have a situation where the coach is under a huge pressure to win next Saturday's game. Otherwise, his game could be on the line. So I'm not sure if concerning the rules, something big should change. Of course, you can debate about it. Like you have the rule of having 6 Belgian players on the game seat right now. Well, you could, of course, extend it. If you look to the other countries here, like second division Germany a couple of years ago, they had like a rule where they would have like a German flag on their game shirt to show that they're domestic. And they would have to have 2 German players on the court at all times, which of course has an implication to the way you're coaching too, because in your rotation, in your subs, that's something you have to keep in mind too. But of course, that's an option too. But the biggest problem is just the mindset of the decision makers, the mindset of the general manager, the mindset of the president of the club.
Is that something that you see can change? Is there a way that that can be, that the problems and the issues that are there right now, is there a way that that can be overcome in the future? Are you hopeful that changes can be made so that it can at least come more towards the direction that you're hoping that it can go to in terms of giving more Belgian players an opportunity? Is that something that you think can happen, or do you think that the system is such that it's going to be really difficult to change?
No, I really think it can and it will happen for 2 reasons. The first one is probably the saddest one. It's the coronavirus. I really think that once this whole thing is over, that a lot of clubs, they will feel the impact and they will feel that they have a smaller budget, and by definition, or because there are just no other solution, they will turn more to domestic players. I think that's one of the hard truths for the sports in Europe of the coronavirus. But I also see something else, and that's a way more positive story. Like, you see that over the last couple of years, that the number of fans in the Belgian arenas, it's not going up. It's even worse. It's going down. You have to ask yourself what's the reason behind all this? And there, I think there's a big difference, because if you play with domestic players and you really give them a future on the mid-long term and the longer term, and they see year after year the same players that are fighting on the court for a good result of the club, it's way more easier for fans to create a bond, to identify themselves with such a team made of such players, compared to other teams where you have 6 new import players, and during the season, 2 of them, they are being cut and replaced by other players, which after the season, either they weren't good enough, so they will be replaced, either they showed what they can do, they have potential, and they move on to a bigger league in France, in Germany, or in Spain. But in any case, the next year, you have 6 new import players. And for fans, it's so hard to create a fan base, because they're having so much trouble to identify themselves with such a team. And I think that's one of the reasons, or one of the things, that Belgian clubs right now, slowly, they get into the process of understanding them.
I think that's almost what happened to some degree with college basketball here in the United States. I think back to 20 years ago with college basketball here in the U.S., and you had players that stayed in college for probably a minimum of 3 years, and fans got to know those players, and you got to know teams. And I feel like today, when the best players come into college basketball here in the U.S., they stay for 1 year and then they go on to the NBA, and you don't really build that connection with them. And I think it's what you're saying there. In Belgium, it sounds like it's a similar situation, where you have all these players from outside of the country that are coming back in, and that they're constantly rotating, and so the fans don't get an opportunity to be able to connect with them. And then as a result, that causes attendance to go down. And I think here in the United States, I think there's, at least to some degree, there's the college basketball is not as, I don't know, it's not as popular. I don't think the product is as good as it was 20 or 30 years ago, when all the best players who eventually ended up in the NBA played for multiple years and fans got to know them. It's just a different game than it used to be. And it sounds like the Belgian system has some of those same problems. But I'm glad you're optimistic that it can change, because I think that that's something that we all have to keep in mind as we're going through. And we talked about it off the beginning of the podcast, that, you know, the game is evolving and systems can evolve, and hopefully they're going to evolve for the better, so that we can all have a better experience within the game. I want to talk to you a little bit about practice design and get into some more specific things. So talk to me a little bit about when you're putting together a practice plan for one of your teams. Talk to me about how you incorporate drills that help your players to become smarter, increase their basketball IQ, for lack of a better way of saying it, make them into better basketball players individually within the confines of your team practice?
Well, that's a very big thing for me. When I design a practice, then every single day I try to design it in a way that, where I know that after the practice, my players are a little bit smarter than before practice. Because I think you have to keep in mind that basketball, it's one of the most complex sports we have. And it is impossible to prepare each player for every single situation they will ever meet in their basketball career. That's just impossible, because you have too many situations and it's impossible to mimic all of them. That being said, the only conclusion I get from that statement is I have to make my players smarter. I have to prepare them to make smart decisions on the court. That also means that if I look to my practice design, I try to skip one of or some things that I have done being a player. Like the three-man weave, for me, it doesn't add anything at all to the game of basketball I want to play. Because what's the three-man weave? We give a pass, we follow the pass, and we end up being at the ball. How many times do you see during a game where coaching that under 10 team where a player gives a pass and he follows the ball and he's going to ask the ball there back? Then I see coaches at the sideline going completely crazy because it's a bad spacing and they create space, whatever, go away. Yeah, but it's what they have done all week long. Another example is the classic 11-man drill where you have a 3-on-2 full court. Well, actually, the way we did it here in Europe, and I think you will recognize it. If not, you have to tell me. In the classic 11-man drill, you have three players in offense attacking two defenders, which are just stationary. They're parked in the paint, in the bucket. We would call it like a tandem defense. And that's the way we would run fast break on practice 30 years ago, every single practice. But then if you ask coaches, how many times in your playing career did it happen to you that you had a three-man break and two defenders were waiting for you like that? It never, ever happens. And then I always wonder, why do we do as coaches the same drills? And the only logic explanation is, yeah, we put them in our practices because we did them as players. That's, of course, that's a very bad reason. So I try to throw out all those things, and it's one of the things I've done over the last couple of years. Every single drill I try to put into a practice, I ask myself, is it useful? Will my players get smarter? And also, is it game-like? Is it a decision that I want my players to have? To give one example, in my fast break into secondary break, I always have the ball on the side of the court. That also means that in my warm-ups, in my fast break drills, I won't design drills where I bring the ball to the middle of the court because it's just not game-like for my basketball philosophy. My ball will always be on the side of the court. I'm talking about that, for example, that 11-man break, 3-on-2. I try to have some drills which are more game-like. So I would do something similar, but the two players, they are just running back in defense. And it will create a drill which is game-like. And also, every single time, it will give me a different situation. Because sometimes those two players running back in defense, they will be ahead of the ball. Sometimes one of them was sleeping on practice and he will be a little bit late. Sometimes they're at the same level because it is a drill I can use often. And by design, it gives me every single time a different situation, which is very game-like. And that's for me the ultimate goal. And what is very huge to me is I want to have a very good intensity on practice. Some of the things I used to learn at the college level in the U.S., I had the chance to go for 2 months to St. Joe's with Coach Martelli to watch his practices. And one of the big things I picked up from college basketball in the U.S., it is the intensity. And it is the speed going from one drill to the other one. And of course, in the US, it's a little bit easier if you have that many managers and assistants and so on. Over here in Europe, you should be very thankful if you have one assistant coach. But still, I do everything to mimic the same intensity. And by having a couple of reference drills, I'm able to do to keep that intensity up. Of course, sometimes you have to teach and you have to hold and you have to talk a little bit. But sometimes I grab back to reference drill, like the one I described just now, the 3-on-2 full court. Then everybody knows what to do. And still, every single time, it's a new situation by design. And for me, that's the ultimate goal. And that's for me a perfect practice drill.
So in your mind, when you're organizing a practice, it sounds like one of the things that's very, very important to you that you think helps to build in these decision-making skills and the intensity is the pace of your practice, meaning that you're in one drill and there's a lot of decision-making involved in it. And then in order to keep up that intensity, you're immediately on to the next drill, which I'm assuming requires you to have this understanding with your players of, okay, we know the name of this drill. We know what this drill is. So after you teach it the first time, your players learn the name of what that drill is and you use the same terminology, that then they can very quickly move from one activity to the next. There's not a lot of, okay, this drill is over. Now we take 5 or 10 minutes to explain the next drill. It's once the drill has been taught, the players are expected to jump right into it. Is that an accurate description of kind of how your practice would run from a pacing standpoint?
Yes, more or less. Actually, for half of it. Let's say that for half of practice, I have some pre-designed drills, some I would call them reference drills because I like to repeat them a lot. And for the rest, actually, it's a little bit different and it can be different from practice to practice. But there is a very big but here, an important one. Actually, when we do a new drill, I want everybody to start moving within 30 seconds or at least 1 minute, not longer. And it also has some consequences. It also means that your drill, it has to be very, very simplistic by design. And it's one of the things I picked up in Spain, because Spain for me has the best youth program in basketball from all over the world. And one of the things I picked up in Spain is that they don't have complicated drills. They don't have a lot of drills where you have four lines and in line one, you have to give a pass and set a screen and then you have to run behind the cone and you have to go to line two, all those things. No, what they do in Spain is they want to work on one aspect of the game. Well, the coach is showing it. Let's take an example. Let's say we're teaching hedging in a ball screen action. Actually, what the coach would do is he would have a player in offense with the ball. He would have a screener and he would show how the defense of the screener should hedge. He just explains it 30 seconds, 1 minute max. And then he says, spread out. Every two players take a ball, go to a basket and do it. And have as many repetitions as we can have in a couple of minutes of time. Instead of creating, designing a drill with three complicated lines where we have to pass and go and then he sets the screen and has to go to line two. No. Just show it, go on the court, do the repetitions. And afterwards, in 3-on-3 situations and 5-on-5 situations, we're going to apply the things we learned in real games, whether that's small-sided games, 3-on-3, or whether that's in more game situations, 5-on-5 right away.
But actually, I love what you
go ahead, Mike.
I love what you said about being able to maximize repetitions, and I think that's something that is critically important at all levels of basketball. I think it's especially important at the youth level where kids are just learning the game and they need to be put into opportunities where they can improve their skills and work on their decision making. Too often, what I've seen at youth practices is you'll have four kids out on the court and the coach is talking and talking and talking and those four kids are standing and there's a bunch of kids on the sideline and then eventually they get and set up the lines like you described and it ends up being that explaining the drill and the complexity of it takes more time and the kids end up standing a lot in the line instead of out there getting repetitions and getting better. And we all know that the way you get better is you have to keep doing things. You have to be able to make mistakes. You have to try things and see what works. And I love just what you're talking about there in terms of getting kids with the ball in their hands, executing the skill, doing it with a defense where there's decision-making involved. And I think if you do that, you're going to end up with a lot better results than you are if it's the coach giving a 5 or 10 minute lecture about what's going to happen and then only a few kids being involved at a time and the rest of the kids standing around. I think the more kids you can get involved when you're coaching, the better off you're going to be, the more reps you're going to get, and the more quickly they're going to be able to improve.
Absolutely. And often I get the questions by coaches, and then actually this week it's coincidental. I got a question from a coach that says, "Yeah, coach, I have a problem. I lack time with my team on the court. Do you have any tricks or something where I can maximize my time with the team on the court?" And actually, for a moment, I thought about it, and there is one single thing. And I would propose that all of your listeners, that they would reflect on it for 10 minutes. Actually, there is a thing you have to think about: how much time you spend on 1-on-0 layups, the regular layups. So then I mean the right, left, with finish with the right hand on the right side, left, right, finish with the left hand on the left side. You have to think for one moment on how much time you spend doing that. I know coaches that do that every single practice with their team as the warm-up, and they do it in the game warm-up, saying, yeah, we can't do anything else because we're not warmed up yet. But actually, if you think about it, I went back and I went to see the EuroLeague semifinal of last season, and I was watching and counting the number of layups from that game. Do you know how many regular layups you had during that game? It was one single layup. And all the rest was scoop layup, euro step, offhand, one step layup, floaters, runners, the whole thing, with decision making and depending on where the defense was on that point. But if then you would go back to, let's say, under 14 team in Belgium, which has two practices a week and one game on Saturday. So that means that they have 3 hours of practice and one half an hour of game warm-up. I think a lot of teams would do 30 minutes of just 1-on-0 layups, which is actually 1/6 of their practice time. And why? Because it doesn't happen during the game. So when I think about it, I have in my practice map, I have like 10, 15 drills, which also involves defense. I would call them advantage drills. It's 1-on-1, but actually you give a huge advantage to the offense. And I mean, how much of an advantage, it depends on the skill level, on the age of the players, and so on. But actually, I would do those kinds of drills, because those kinds of drills, they add decision making. And they work on different styles of layups instead of the right, left, finish with the right hand. And if you think about it, it's quite old school. And old school coaches, they would say, nah, I'm not starting with my team with one-step layups, Euro-step, if they cannot finish 100 layups in a row, when they can hit 100 in a row. Which actually is maybe a little bit stupid, no? Because we have to prepare them for game situations. And yeah, it's one of the things. And actually, it's an invitation to all of your listeners to reflect for a couple of minutes on how you design your practices and how much time you spend on 1-on-0 layups. And please look back to your last game and count the number of regular layups.
I think it's a great point. I love what you just said there in terms of trying to make it as game-like as you possibly can when you're working on finishing around the basket. Give me one or maybe two examples of advantage-disadvantage drills that you use to help your players finish layups around the basket using different kinds of finishes. So just give us one or two specific drills that you can explain quickly and easily that coaches can grab and start using in their practices.
Okay. Let's take my favorite one. So me as a coach, I will be standing on the 45 degrees on the left side behind the three-point line, and I'm having a ball in my hands. And on the other side, on the 45 degrees behind the three-point line, you have a player in offense and a player in defense standing next to each other facing the basket. When I blow my whistle, the player in offense, he has to cut towards the basket. I will throw some kind of pass to him, and he has to grab my pass and finish the layup. but he cannot make a jump stop. He cannot dribble. He has to finish that layup on his way to the basket. And depending a little bit on the skill level and the age of the players, I would do this with, or let's say it better, I already did this with under 10 kids, but I also do it with professional teams and professional players. And depending on the skill level, I don't even try to give good passes. I just, sometimes it's a lob pass into the paint, sometimes it's a bounce pass, sometimes I roll it over the floor, bad pass, whatever, one hand, left hand, I just throw it in there. But if you think about it, isn't it just a little bit game-like having a player with the defender cutting to the basket, trying to catch a bad pass and still try to finish that layup? And we can do 1-on-0 layup lines for hours with a perfect pass. But during the game, there is a defender involved. And on top of that, during the game, because of the ball pressure, it might happen that the pass isn't as ideal as in 1-on-0. And that's one of my favorite drills, actually.
I love that.
Very simple.
I'm going to share one too that I don't think I've shared it on the podcast, but I'm curious if it's one that you've ever seen or heard. One of the ones that I like to do is I'll put two players could be at the 3-point line, could be at the free throw line, again, depending upon the age of the player. And the players are lined up, both of them, one behind the other. So one player is facing the basket, the other player is directly behind them. And the player who is on offense has the ball. They're the second person in the line facing the basket, and they put the basketball, they touch it to the player's back in front of them. So they're holding it against that player's back. And then when that player removes the ball and starts to make their move, the defender is facing the same direction. So the defender has to then try to turn and stop the offensive player from scoring. It essentially becomes one-on-one. But the advantage for the offense is that the defense is facing the wrong way and doesn't know when the player is going to remove that basketball from touching their back. And so it's a great way, again, to have the kids practice finishing layups, finishing moves to the basket with a defense, but yet gives them a slight advantage so that you can be sure that they're going to get a shot off as they're doing it. So I love that one. It's just, again, a simple drill.
I love it too. I know the drill. I use it often, and I just love it because of all the reasons you give by yourself. And this is way more useful than just doing another layup line 1-on-0. And you can experiment with it. Instead of having the ball in the back of the other player, you can start both behind the 3-point line, both of them next to each other, but facing the basket. And for instance, they have to touch the inside hand, one with the other. And the moment the player in offense, he has the ball, of course, in his other hand. The moment he releases the hand to hand, he starts playing an offense. And the other one, he can play live defense. And it's also the type of drills that players, they love it. Because it's a competition. They want to score. And the other one, he wants to stop them. And I also encourage my players in defense to take a gamble, to try at least something. We know that they all start with a disadvantage. Well, just don't take the loss. Please, try something. Try to surprise it. Try to do something unexpectedly in defense. And it helps our offense. Because if those players are really trying something, then it involves more and better decision maker for the player on offense.
All right. I would be remiss if I didn't ask a mathematician at least one question about some analytics before we wrap things up. So just give me an idea of how you use analytics in your coaching. What are some of the most important advanced metrics that you look at when you're coaching your team? What are some of the most important things that you think coaches should be looking at from an analytics standpoint if they have access to the kind of statistics that you might have, let's say at the university level?
I love analytics. It won't surprise you, of course. I do have a PhD in mathematics and I'm a professional coach. That's the ideal combination to be completely in love with analytics. But then, of course, we also all have to realize that we don't have the same resources as we have in the NBA with the player tracking and the sports view, all the cameras and so on. So neither do we have it here in Europe. So we're a little bit limited. But actually, if you just have like the box score of a game, another league, you can already do so many things. And you can go over the four factors of Dean Oliver's book. You can look at the pace of the game. You can, I mean, now I'm probably jumping from one thing to the other. There's so many things you can do. How do I use it as being the coach with my team week to week? I try not to overdo it because believe me, players, they are not waiting in the evening once a week for another mathematics class. That's not what they are waiting for. Believe me, I tried it. I've been there. Doesn't work. But what does work is every single game I prepare, I try to get one number out of analytics. And actually, so that means if we go into a game plan, we have three or four key points in going into the game. One of those points is made up out of analytics. And often I do give them a number. And for instance, it really depends what I did in the past, because my team sometimes they call me crazy, but what I did once is count the number of dribbles in a game from our team. And I compared it to another team because we all had the feeling that we weren't sharing all as much and so on. So actually what I did is I watched two games and I counted the number of dribbles. And when you start telling that to your team in a film room, they look at you as you're coming from a different planet. They really think that you don't have any social life at all. Oh, coach, he spent his day off by counting the number of dribbles in a game. But believe me, you have to sell it in a way to make your point. And those things, it can have your team on the same page. And it also gets, or it also creates a gig. I remember doing that, and it was in the beginning of the week, and all week long, we were referring to, oh, yeah, the coach is counting the number of dribbles. But I can tell you, by the end of the week, we had a great flow into going into that game, and it helped us for a couple of weeks. And for a couple of weeks, I only had to remind them of, oh, yeah, the number of dribbles. Coach is going to count them. And now, of course, I do have the feeling that I'm disappointing you huge because you are asking me about analytics. And what I bring up is the number of dribbles.
No, that's not a disappointment. I love what you said because here's why. Because I think that what you said makes so much sense to me from a standpoint of you have to keep it simple, especially with what you're going to use with players. Now, you may, as a coach, go far more in depth and look at different statistics and analytics that can help you with your design of your offensive sets, your defensive sets, the things that you're trying to accomplish in your practices. But I think in terms of what you would share with players, I love the idea of picking out one single simple metric that you can use with your team to try to influence their behavior out on the floor. And I think that story that you just shared is a great easy way for coaches to be able to think about how do I use analytics? Because we all can get into and dive into the numbers as deeply as we want to as coaches. And as you said, depending on what level you're coaching at, you may have access to different numbers or not have access to different numbers. But there are simple things from a statistical standpoint that you can share with your team that can have a clear impact, things that players can simply and easily understand. And then you're making a point of how you want them to change their behavior out on the floor. And I think that story that you gave is a perfect one because it's one, again, that I think is actionable for coaches out there. And if you just, and it doesn't even have to be number of dribbles, you just take one metric, whatever that is, and you use that with your team in a particular week of practice over the course of a month or something that you're working on. And to me, that's great advice, because I think sometimes we can get overly complex and then what we really need to do gets lost in that. So I really did appreciate the simplicity of your story.
Yeah, it's exactly, you're right. There's a very big difference between what we as coaches have to know and what to understand, whether that's basketball knowledge or analytics stuff, and what we share with the team, because it's not the same. Analytics-wise, you cannot share everything with your team, because first of all, you will drive them crazy. They won't understand it. And second, and most importantly, it won't help them. And of course, analytics goes way further than just counting dribbles. For maybe for the listeners, if I may, I do have like a homepage. It's my full name.com, pascalmeurs.com. And actually, for the listeners that leave their email address over there, I will share like a coaching newsletter with them. And also, I promise them to send them a copy of my free ebook, and it's concerning basketball analytics. So for those who are interested, I will be able to share it with them.
Pascal's newsletter is great for those people who are out there. If you haven't subscribed, I would highly recommend it. And I think actually this will be a perfect way to kind of wrap up our episode as we're heading towards an hour and a half, Pascal. And that's a story that you recently shared just about a club in Spain and their wall of dreams that you put onto your blog and as part of your newsletter. If you could just quickly share that story, and then we'll let you reshare your contact information before we wrap things up. But if you would just share that wall of dreams story, I think that's one that kind of touches a nerve with some of the things that have been themes of our show over the course of the time that we've been doing the podcast. Just, I think it does a really great job of showing what coaching basketball should be all about. And just share that story with us.
Yes, absolutely. I just called Spain already the best youth program all over the world. And of course, because there is great basketball knowledge, but also because there is a great basketball culture and tradition. And sometimes when we discuss it here in Europe, people very quickly, they say, yeah, but it's Spain and they have a different culture and so on. Well, actually, I have one story, and it's a great example of how you can create and build such a tradition and a culture as being a club without that it has to cost a lot of money. And of course, it's only one piece of the puzzle. It won't be the magical solution for every club to create that same culture. It's not that easy either, but it's one piece. And the story is, it's the club of Valencia in Spain, where I was happy to spend half of a year where I could work. And actually, what they do have in their main gym, they created a wall of dreams. And actually, they have a great facility, and they did it in a very nice way, so it also looks very great. But what they do is, every kid on that club that played, let's say, at least it is 3 years for the youth program of that club, and if then one day he makes it to the first team and he plays his first minutes on the court with the first team, they add officially the name of the player on that dream of walls. And if you go to Valencia and you go to that club and you go to the dream of walls, you see every single year they have one or two players that made it through the dream of walls. And if you go to my homepage, you will see some very nice pictures of the event. Because actually, the event, it shows everything. The adding the name of that player, DM, on the wall of dreams, they made a complete happening about it. The whole gym was packed. They had all the youth kids of the team. They were shaking hands, high fives, as he was the new star of Club Valencia. They made a team picture with all the youth coaches that ever worked with Guillem during his youth program for the club. And like those youth coaches in Spain, they're the best in the world. they don't earn a lot of money by doing it. They just do it because they want to be part of Valencia basketball, and they are so passionate about it. Why do they do it? What's the return they get? It's not the little money they get, but it's the pride. It's being on that team picture. They had their part of the success of BM, and they helped turning him into an ACB player. And that, for me, that sums it all up. That's the reason why each one of us is coaching basketball. It's not about the money, because then we took the wrong business. Then I should have accepted that in the bank. Basketball, it's about passion. And that story sums up exactly why we are coaches.
That is a fantastic story. It's a fantastic way to end our episode together. I think you did a great job of sharing that, and sharing just, again, your why of what coaching basketball means to you and why it's been so important to you and such an important part of your life. Before I wrap things up, I want to give you one more opportunity. Share where people can go to find out more about you, share how they can reach out to you, how they can subscribe to your newsletter. And then once you share all that contact information, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yes. So since a couple of years, I have my own coaching website. And actually, it is myfullname.com. So it is pascalmeurs.com. If you leave your email address there, I will, every 2 weeks, I send out a free coaching newsletter with some great content. Sometimes it's analytics, sometimes it's a video breakdown, sometimes it's an analysis, or sometimes it's a great story from Spain. And actually, also on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram, and I share video breakdowns, so don't hesitate to hit me up there. Also, if you have a question of something of the podcast or something else, basically, if you want to talk basketball, you can always find me online on social media, and don't hesitate to contact me. And also, Mike, I want to thank you for doing such a great job with your podcast, and also for having me. It has been a blast. I'm surprised that time flew by so fast, but we had a great talk, and I do want to thank you sincerely for it.
Absolutely. The time always goes super fast. I tell people all the time as we're talking, I'll frequently be in the middle of the conversation, and by the time I look up, we're already at the 1 hour mark, and it just, as you said, it goes very, very quickly. And I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your schedule to spend some time with us. I would highly encourage everybody to go and subscribe to Pascal's newsletter. He does a great job with that. And we'll link up all the things and contacts that he put. We'll link those all up in the show notes. And again, Pascal, can't thank you enough for spending time with us this morning, this afternoon, where you are there in Belgium. And stay safe and healthy. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us.
so we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their Ultimate Shooting Guide and Video Program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite-level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.